Oh, hey, who's
Yep, that's how we get started on writer stuff, just rolling in deep talk of Yellow Jackets and Lincoln Lawyer and nothing else going on Tuesday, November 5th. So
Taco just, Tuesday.
I do think I think it would only be appropriate though if we started today with, since we're all animal lovers, with a moment of silence for Peanut. I forgot the name of the raccoon. So he's a raccoon, but squirrels are cute. So I don't know if you guys care enough to take a minute for Peanut, but I don't know.
What befell Peanut?
Oh, Peanut. Oh, you don't know about Peanut?
I don't know.
Dude, we've got 4 acres here and we've got squirrels and raccoons and all kinds of stuff. And I heard about this whole squirrel and peanut thing or raccoon thing. I didn't know until I looked it up, and it's this guy who I follow, and it's the sweetest thing.
Oh, so you're invested. I was just making fun of the whole thing, but
I recognize that guy. I'm like, oh my God, that's the squirrel guy. So anyways.
Yeah. So Peanut, this dude found Peanut, a baby squirrel, and he raised him as a pet for like 6 years. And then some Karen apparently like reported him for harboring a fugitive squirrel.
Of course she
and it
did.
Was such a big deal that local law enforcement decided to raid his house, take Peanut and we should call raccoon, like Ricky the raccoon, and euthanized him instead of like just letting him go. Like, which I'm guessing a squirrel,
the owner or the raccoon.
The raccoon and squirrel. Like I know we're all dog people here, and I think it translates to squirrel somehow because they've got the bushy tail, so they're not like rats. They're cute, so people care. Yeah. But I don't know, man. If somebody ever was like, "Hey, your dog's a fugitive," I'd be like, "We'll be in Mexico by the time you get here, Johnny." Absolutely. Law.
Bring it.
I don't know. I don't know. That's I feel for that guy. I don't know what his name is, but I felt it just pertinent to take a moment for Peanut the Squirrel and hope it never happens again, to get the word out.
Peanut the Squirrel. So he's Peanut the Squirrel. That was John Stamp. This is Writer Stuff. I'm Jeff Circle, and we are here with a friend I call El Presidente, Mr. John Adams. John, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Happy to be here.
Where are you tonight?
I'm in the Poconos in Pennsylvania, and I won't tell you what happened to the gray squirrels that penetrated upstairs last year, but
they went away.
I didn't treat them like pets.
did they go off to the farm to play with the other squirrels?
They did. Everyone I caught, I took to a farm and set free.
The philanthropy. This is wonderful, Johnny.
It's empathy. It's an empathy.
That's John, and the empathy really comes out right here in Second Term. I know we're not on video, but I'm holding up the book Second Term by John Adams, and right on the cover it says, "We'll hold you tight until all is revealed." That's from Steve Barry. John Land, who's a prolific writer, says Second Term is second to none when it comes to high stakes action and nonstop thrills. And Jerome Priestler says in his debut novel Second Term, J.M. Adams keeps the pages of this political thriller turning at a blistering pace. So, John, we're going to talk about this. We're going to talk about some other stuff, too. But thanks for joining us. We're recording this on Election Day. And we just thought it was just really funny to schedule this on Election Day. Because your book is called Second Term. And there's a lot of different ways we can go with this interview. John, if you don't mind, and John, let's talk about Angelina Jolie.
Salt.
John, I'm a fan.
Exactly.
Salt has a lot of, when I first saw that movie, especially the way she killed Liev Schreiber at the end.
with the handcuffs.
When she broke his neck like that, I was like, that's the kind of girl I'd like to take home to mom had I been single.
All right, we can just stop the podcast right here. We've got our soundbite and everything. That's the kind of girl I want to take home to mom. John, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, that's that. You know, she can take care of herself. That's a fan. And you know to take care of yourself, because there's no coming back from handcuffs to the throat. That hyoid bone's not going to last.
Liev Schreiber was very unhappy with that course of action, but that having been said, there is definitely a little bit of salt in the protagonist in my book of Cora Walker. I was looking for somebody who had a little moral flexibility in her dealings with her enemies.
Well, are there any other parallels? Because in the movie, she's a Russian spy who, you know, went to Russian spy school with Liv Schreiber, and she ends up kind of doing the right thing. I don't know. I mean,
and that's exactly what Cora does. A lot of people who read the book thought that Cora was going to go in one direction, and she went completely the other way, and she went the other way because of her moral code. The way I had plotted the book was that she was supposed to take care of a certain couple individuals, and in each case she let them live, which I was disappointed in her, but I respected her decision.
I love it when the characters decide halfway through that they're going to take a giant turn and not tell you about it until you're writing.
Yeah, I don't like that, but I accept it. I begrudgingly accept it. So,
what is that? And the quote you have in the book, where she's sitting there and she's like, "I don't know where the moral cog fell out of me to that of the to let the morality of my actions catch up with me." Like, I know I'm butchering it, but it was just like she's just sitting there, and be like, "I don't know why I don't feel bad about this, but screw those guys."
Yeah. When she gunned down a bunch of guys who were going to go into the back of the embassy, there was six of them, and she cut them all down, and she's like, I would love to feel bad about this, but they kind of had it coming, and it's God's will. So, and the fact of the matter is her justification almost every time she is forced to, terminate people with extreme prejudices, you know, it's done for a higher cause. It's done to save other lives.
There are a ton of good lines from this book, and I'm going to read a couple here. Just as a setup, a set of double exit doors flies open, and this low-key meeting devolves into a Walmart Black Friday sales event where people stampede one another for matching sets of Santa salt and pepper shakers. Page 33. I sentence you to spend the remainder of your tortured existence pursued by an army of ghosts. That's way deep into the book, John. Where are you going with that? An army of ghosts. Where'd you pull that out of?
Well, since the villain, if you will, had just bombed a city street and killed several hundred people, she thought that it would be a more fitting punishment to let him live with the ramifications of his actions. As you find out in the sequel, he was completely okay with what he did and why he did it. And for that reason, I'm glad I kept him alive. But the fact of the matter is he was trying to make an excuse. He said it was supposed to be a diversionary bomb, but instead it was more of a, I believe she described it as a bunker buster, which if you've spent any time in the Middle East, especially Iraq, you know that bunker busters were basically what we used to level all the impenetrable, indestructible Czech-built hangars in Kuwait along the Iraqi border.
Let's introduce you. We're going to run this a little backwards. Let's talk a little bit about your past then. You brought up Bunker Buster. Something you and I have in common is Desert Storm. And while you're having creme brulee and cappuccinos in a nice, you know, padded
It's called the air service.
Yeah. I'm on the ground somewhere in an undisclosed location, but you have quite a bit of field experience. You're, you know, 15 years as a field reporter doing some Emmy level work. So talk to us a little bit about the Emmy level work that you've done as a reporter and how that came about from your experience overseas in Desert Storm.
Well, Desert Storm itself, I was dug in at Ali al-Saleem, and I started at Al Jaber, which are both in extreme northern Kuwait, right there on the Iraqi border. As a matter of fact, they called Ali al-Saleem the tip of the spear. And
I thought that was your nickname, but okay.
Yes. Well, we won't go down that road. But spending time with the Air Force, I mean, I got to hang out with the PJs. And if you don't know what they are, they are the badasses of the Air Force. They do demolition, they do diving, they go into hot zones and rescue people. They are, you know, when somebody's in trouble, those are they're kind of the Ghostbusters in the war zone. And so I did brownout landings with them. We toured the Highway of Death.
Oh yeah.
For those who don't know, was 34 mile highway of burnout APCs, armored personnel carriers, destroyed tanks, burned cars, and they all clogged on one road, and the A-10 Warthogs just went down a 30-mile stretch of road, and they made sure that there was nothing left except burned metal. And even flying over it, you know, years after that initial attack, I mean, you could still smell the burning metal. Like, it was still, I mean, obviously the desert doesn't cool off that much. And, you know, where I was pretty much, like, it was 125, 130 every day. But
during that time, were you still running around in all soft tops? Is that before everything was like up armored? Is that just zipping all over the place? Yeah, all soft tops. Yeah.
Yeah. hats off to our A-10 pilot friend, Ward Larson. Thank you, Ward.
Yeah. Yes, and I will say that the A-10 is, to me, the most impressive aircraft. There's, you know, jets now that stop on the dime and pirouette and do cartwheels, but those A-10 Warthogs come in, they're armor-plated, they get hit by about 1,000 shells on every run, and they just blow the hell out of everything that's in their path.
I encourage everyone to watch a video of an A-10 firing its main gun.
Yeah, and also there's nothing better.
David Montham Air Force Base, which is where, I don't know if they're still stationed there, but the squadron at David Montham, if you go there to the airport graveyard, they're just running A-10 sorties and trainings like 18 hours a day. And, you know, that experience in the Middle East had a very big impact on shaping how I wrote this book. Obviously, the first 10 or 11 chapters all takes place in Benghazi. I will say I've never been to Benghazi, but I've been to Baghdad. And basically, if you've been to Baghdad and you're reading that, you might say, you know, this sounds more like Baghdad than it does Benghazi. But as I said, I didn't spend much time in Benghazi to know. But I do know that it was a war-torn nation during when they did the attack on the ambassador. It was only a year after Muammar Gaddafi was exterminated by his people. So basically those times in the war zone were actually very, and I got to spend a lot of time at Moody Air Force Base. So I was doing little training missions with them all the time. And they also did mock disasters where there's like 80 people lying dead in a field and they're triaging. And, so all of that experience definitely was, it was certainly a major building block for me becoming an author later.
I actually had a question about that, because I always wondered how you were, I guess, with airmen, like how they treated you. Like, you know, they've got this new guy embedded, a reporter of all things. How do you build rapport with those guys? And is it just constant suspicion, or are they just like, hey, cool, he's going to put me on the news?
actually, I'll tell you, I got very, very lucky, because I get sick in helicopters. There's just no way around it. And I was in helicopters every single day. And I grew up with a father who was a private pilot. And if you've ever been in a little Cessna, they fly like this. Like, if there's just a breeze, you're literally, you know, you're going to become a charcoal briquette on the side of a mountain. Actually, that's not true. It's 10 times safer than any other form of transportation. But the fact of the matter is you feel every bump. So I got a lot of experience throwing up in small crafts as a child. So when I was thrown up in the helicopter, there was one specific incident where we did the brownout landing, and I had just filled up like the fourth bag, and I had a handheld camera, and looking through a camera when you're in a helicopter is, if you have any kind of air sickness, it augments it by 10 times. To me, being in a helicopter is like skipping a rock on the water. Like, military. I've never been on a civilian helicopter, but I've been on 30 military helicopters, and they all skip They don't just fly. They skip. But what happened is literally the first day we did the brownout landing, I was puking and puking and puking, and I was getting all this great video, and they're like, you know, do you want us to take you back? And I was like, for what? I'm like, let's go.
This is awesome.
Doing great.
And so the next morning at breakfast, they did this whole thing where they're like, they come in and like, and they all surround me and they're like, and they told the story about me throwing up and going, like, what are you talking about? Let's go. And they're like, to the toughest son of a bitch reporter I've ever seen. And so after that, like I was more like a celebrity than an idiot. So that was
rapport established. All right. I got to do is throw up. I haven't thrown up. I threw up way less than last time.
Right. But the fact of the matter is the fact that I didn't care that I was throwing up, they found wildly entertaining. Because they were just like, why don't – because normally when anybody, whether it's a military person or a civilian or especially a reporter, if they throw up, you know, they're like, oh, my God, take me back. I'm going to die. As where I'm like, this is the greatest video I've ever seen in my life. Like that brownout landing was phenomenal. And the fact that I puked through half of it didn't ruin the experience, nor did it ruin the story.
Nice. Yeah, that was my question because it's civilians over there, it's like you got to hitchhike. You like maybe you get a ride someplace, maybe you don't, but you're at the mercy of, you know, it's not like you can walk into a place and be like, hey, I got to go here, and they're like, that's awesome, have a seat, maybe Friday on a Tuesday you'll go. But so when you had that, do you guys have like a deal set up, or are you kind of on the same thing? If you switch units or have to get to a location, you've got to kind of beg, borrow, and steal to get to where you need to go.
So in the Air Force, I held. You are basically given the designation of, for this particular trip with Moody Air Force Base, because they invited me, they gave me the designation of a captain. So I got captain privileges, and the fact that I didn't act like a captain, I think helped a lot. And the fact that I had been around, you know, I grew up in a military family and I've been around military people my whole life, that also helped as well. Because when you have a reporter that doesn't have that experience, they have more of a problem relating, as where I had the knucklehead gene that they appreciated. Not that Jeff was a knucklehead. I'm sure he was a upstanding member of our armed services. But
I never rode in a helicopter while I was in the Army. I rode in a helicopter 100 times later as a contractor going through Eastern Afghanistan on a red team assignment. And you're right. I understand what you're saying about how it skips. The problem with us was in the altitudes in the mountains, especially when there's any kind of weather, is the winter is really hard to get through some of those passes. So we would get stuck a lot, but that was a blast. That was one of the coolest things I ever done. So, you know, it's funny how your career and my experience kind of has so many similarities, and yet they're still so different. And it just reminds me of, you know, the theme of your book and the theme of today being Election Day is how many more things we actually have in common with each other.
Right.
Right.
Just one more helicopter story is helicopters don't react well to bursts of heat. And when I was at a massive forest fire in, I don't know if it was Wyoming or Colorado, but it was one of them, but we were in a Department of Forestry helicopter. And every time we went over a particularly hot plume, it would kind of stall out. And we, you know, yeah. And
not cool, man.
And my photographer was just like, oh my God. And I was like, awesome. Like, you can't be upset. Like, if you crash, fine. But, you know, you have to enjoy the ride. Like, and I didn't get sick in that one because, you know, there was so much smoke that comes into the cabin. But that was high times. I really enjoyed that.
And now, I mean, now that I don't know if you're still out, you know, chasing stories or not now and then, but in situations like that, like, what is it like between those two, you and your cameraman, like when the pilot's like, hey, you want to jump up and go fly over this 1,000-acre fire with no place to land? You're like, that sounds awesome. Let's go. What is that? Okay. What's the cog that didn't show up that you're like, that's an awesome idea. Let's just go.
It's just the birth defect. But my cameramans are always like, dude, we're not doing that. And I was like, we are doing that. And then they you know, a lot of them bitch the whole time. They're like, this is stupid. This is
dumb. This is so dumb. It's I'm not doing that.
I'm like, look down this whole, like, that's 1,000 acres of blazing forest. Like, you'll never see anything like this again.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the experience, right? It's that's the Wamba quote. The thing about, he said it about police officers, I'm going to destroy it. But it was like, you know, police officers aren't action junkies. They're not there to be superheroes, but they always just want to be part of it. Whatever the experience is, no matter how crazy it is, they just want to be a witness to history. So I guess it's got to be like that same gene. You just want to see it. There's an amazing thing there. I have to be a part of this.
Well, and that really benefits you in a newsroom, because you make it very clear when you're a new reporter, they're like, no matter what, the more gruesome it is, or the more horrible it is, or the more ridiculous it is, they, you know, nobody puts their hand up and they're like, Adams. I'm like, yes, I'm the guy. And that also helps me get selected for things like going out with the US Navy during, you know, 9/11. And that's why I get selected to go to Iraq, because they know that I want to do everything. Like, I don't want to leave anything out. And that's really why I became a journalist, is because, I didn't want to leave any, I wanted to turn over every single stone that I could find. And that's why I did it. Journalism started to become something a little different later in my career. I had to cover, after Anna Nicole Smith had died, I had to figure out who impregnated her a year earlier, who was going to get her fortune. And I was like, I'm a combat correspondent. Why am I in Florida trying to figure out who knocked up Anna Nicole Smith? Come on. Like, that's what news became. It became more and more entertainment. And then literally when I got out, I was in a dentist chair, and they had Fox or CNN. It didn't matter. But whatever they were doing, they were talking about what was on in another network. When I was in the news, we never talked about what another station did. It didn't matter. That wasn't news. It's not news to say Fox did this or CNN did this. Your job is to report the news, not what other people are doing. And so news really took a really hard turn. And then with social media, where suddenly everybody's an expert, even if you have a fifth or sixth grade education, that's a problem. And I literally got out just in time, because I would have done something unconscionable on the air. So luckily, and it was also right before YouTube. So, you know, the only video evidence of me on television is my own.
Well, I just wonder, you know, how much your career changed when Anchorman came out. We've had this conversation before.
It was enhanced greatly.
Let's talk about some of those lines that I know are coming out of your head right now.
No, well, I mean, rules not in the head or the face. Don't touch the hair or the face.
It's I have many leather-bound books that sit in my rich mahogany bookcase. I embraced the whole Anchorman thing, much to a lot of the more serious journalists. They were just like, that's not funny. And I was like, you know, if you can't laugh at yourself, then you probably shouldn't watch a Will Ferrell movie to begin with.
Yeah, John has a trident.
I do love the trident. And I really, for some reason, I always remember Brick as the guy that puts the mayonnaise in the toaster. That really, I haven't done it yet, but I think there will be a point where I'm going, not at my own house, but at somebody else's, where I'm going to have to, like, Jeff, you want to invite me over? You got some. Yeah.
It's okay, but I just pooped a hammer.
That's right, Brick. What is it? 60% of the time, it works every time.
They've done studies. They've done studies.
Panther. It's science.
Oh, my God. It's science.
So I found that to be a big boost. And honestly, yes, it's a satire, but honestly, it's not that far from what a lot of people do. One of the reasons I always got out to do the most awful stories was because I didn't want to do the story about the cat in the tree. I didn't want to do the story about the mayor saying that we're going to add 3 garbage cans, you know, onto Main Street. Like, I just couldn't I couldn't care less. So that's why when there was a butcher, a murder, a car accident that's killed a van full of children, I'm like, I'll do it. And, you know, I'm not going to say that, you know, there was a lot of stories that I did. I mean, the reason I wrote, the reason Cora Walker, the reason she became a character is because I did a lot of stories on abuse crimes against children. And I did it specifically because I realized after the second or third story I did that the judges were much harder on the perpetrators when there was a camera in court, because he goes to church and he has to live in the community. And so when he sees, you know, that idiot John Adams in there, he knows that if he doesn't drop the hammer on this person who has hurt the children, then he has to live with it in the community. And
that's my awesome
prequel before second term, it dealt with that.
First term?
No, not first term. it's called Blood Feud, and it's lived in a drawer. I haven't given it to the public yet, but I plan on rolling it out after I finish the book I'm working on right now.
Well, real quick, before we wrap up, I'm really excited about your next book. I lived in Texas for a while, and so I understand a little bit about the border. You have done some amazing firsthand research with risk to yourself. And I don't know how much you want to go into, you know, the conversations you and I have had offline, but politics aside, this has nothing to do with politics. You have seen some shit go down, brother. And yeah, you've been right in the middle of it.
I loved my time in Mexico. I told my wife that I'd have to go to Mexico a couple times if I were going to write, you know, a novel about deportation. And I did run into issues with the Federales and Juarez. I ran into real problems with Immigration Customs Enforcement in California, of all places.
Huh.
I got surrounded by four ICE truck, one van, one car, and they all get out and they're like, out of the car. And I'm like, what? And I'm in California. Okay. And they're like, state your business. And I'm like, I'm an American in California. And they're like, state your business. And I was like, still an American, still in California. Like, you know, and then the girl brushes her holster. And I was like, yeah, shoot me, shoot this fat 50-year-old white guy. I was like, you'll be on the cover of Newsweek. It'll make you famous, please. But basically every experience I had in Mexico, walking to the border, driving to the border, going into Juarez, going into Laredo, going to Piedra, I spent a lot of time in Shelby Park. And Shelby Park is in Eagle Pass, which is right there in the Rio Grande, where they put up the water buoys and everything.
Yeah.
And the last 10 chapters of the book I've just written all deal with Piedras Negras and Eagle Pass and what's going on there in Shelby Park. Shelby Park, and funny, Shelby Park is named after General Shelby, a particularly vicious Civil War general who really, really had a, he was a Confederate general, and he had a very brutal relationship with African Americans. And I always found it ironic that Shelby Park is named after him. But down there at that border, I was basically hiding in the bushes while guys in airboats were, like, you know, pulling up next to me and guys. But I mean, I saw so much. And what I really saw was that more important than illegal immigration, we're spending billions at that border. And there's got to be a better way than putting five helicopters in the sky, 50 vans, 50 airboats, you know, on that little isolated stretch of Rio Grande. I mean, to what end? I mean, there has to be a better way to allocate that money. Like, whatever we're doing right now isn't working. And that's kind of about what this book is about, is that our immigration policies, literally since 2016 have been a disaster. Like, things have gotten so much worse from 2016 to now. But you look at, like, when Reagan was president, he was like, okay, you can be in this country as an illegal alien. And we just, it was like, don't ask, don't tell. So Republicans used to be very pro-immigration and Democrats used to be very anti-immigration. And that's kind of like, Jeff, what you heard when I was talking. I said, the two-party system is such a mess because I said, I was talking about how Republicans, Democrats are ready to kill each other over whether or not we should have pennies. If you're willing to kill over a penny, then perhaps there's something wrong with the two-party system.
Yeah, it's a little ridiculous. About your trip, it's something that you're not going to do again, are you?
Well, it depends. Whatever the topic is, I'll go where the topic, like what the topic is. Now,
what I mean is the trips to Texas, you later found out that that was probably something you shouldn't have been doing.
Well, the Juarez for sure. The neighborhoods I went to in Juarez, I did encounter some cartel members at the fence. And I think that they don't know what to do with me.
That's a recurring theme in your career, John.
I'm such an anomaly in Mexico. I mean, I'm obviously not a native to the country. And I'm a few inches taller than just about everyone who's in that country, and I'm completely at ease. And I think that's the part that makes them perhaps give me a little bit of leeway because I'm too stupid to know that I could be in danger because I'm just walking around like a reporter asking questions and doing what I do.
So since you've left, do they have your picture on tequila bottles?
I hope so.
Missing American reporter.
He's a conspiracy theory. If you go to the border some nights, you'll see a giant man asking weird questions.
Right. And the funny thing is when, a little old man came out and he was like, because I didn't know the guys who were talking to me. You know, they don't come out there, hi, I'm with the cartel. He's like
cartel. They don't flash their creds.
And he basically said, he's like, you should get the hell out of here. And I was like, I'm like, well, that's a good tip. Thank you. And I mean, I spent another 20 minutes there. I got what I needed and then I left. But it was nice of him to let me know that the two, skinny gentlemen with greasy hair were cartel members because I just thought they were idiots giving me a hard time.
Like that scene in Anchorman when they have the big fight with all the different networks. So that escalated quickly.
Yes. That escalated quickly.
And actually, where I was on the fence, 3 hours later, because I subscribed to something called Border Report, and it's all just border news from California all the way to Texas. Three people were stoned where I was 3 hours early. 3 hours after I left, three people tried to get over the wall, and they didn't pay their cartel tax. And so the cartel, to make an example of them, stoned them to death. And when I saw the pictures on Border Report, they matched the pictures on my phone, except there were no bodies. And I was like, so this probably wasn't a good area. But I told the cabbie, I said, take me to the most frequented, attempts to get over the fence. So that's where he took me.
Good man.
Man, awesome. That's some medieval shit right there. Mm. Way to send a message.
You know what's so funny is when it said stoned, I thought, okay, so they got high. So what? And then I read a little closer. And I'm like, oh, this is like Exodus and Leviticus.
Oh, stoned. Oh,
like 2,000-year-old stoning. Yeah. Different kind of stoning altogether.
Well, there you have it, everybody. John Adams, J.M. Adams, does his research. He did it on second term, and he's doing it on the book that you'll see soon. JMAdams.com, and you can find out more about John at thewritersdossier.com and John Stamp, JohnStampWriter.com. Check us all out. Second term. Anything else going on? I'll see you on Sunday.
Yep. See you on Sunday. I did win my 8th award, but it has not translated into sales, fascinatingly enough.
Well, we're trying to change that.
It happens. Yeah.
Every time you get it, they're like, you are now, like conspiracy thriller, best new thriller.
Multi-award winning. Yes.
Right. Yeah. And then I'm like, oh, wow, I got all these awards. And I'm like, and then I look at the sales and I'm like, nobody told anybody.
Yeah. Well, hey, when does that needle start moving?
Right. Like, when does it move the needle? That's what I want to know.
Keep telling.
It's after this episode. It's right after this episode. Yeah. Right. It'll move Wednesday next week.
It's 1,000 books right there.
That's right. That's right. All right. Well, fellas, I appreciate it. This is always a blast, and good luck surviving election night. And you know what? I really think the Green Party is going to do some great things in January of 2025. I think it's going to be amazing. So
I will tell you, if Nader can take Vermont, we're good.
I've done a media blackout for 2 days. Like for two days, the only website I brought up is ESPN.com. I'm going to participate by not participating.
Good for you.
I did that starting today. Yep. It's I just can't be a part of it, but I'm hoping. I mean, all you Green Party guys, just hold out hope. Make sure you vote.
There you go.
Right. Awesome.
2032.
That's right. All right. Thanks, fellas.
And, all right.
Good night, everybody.
All right. Good night.